Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Zach Harold, guest hosting this week's show. A lot has changed about the world in the past few months. The coronavirus has upended so many things in our lives, from school to work to grocery shopping. But social distancing and staying home is also giving us some space. Space to explore forgotten traditions.
What are we making today?
We're making popovers!
While lots of things have been canceled, spring hasn't. And here in Appalachia, that means ramps, those pungent green leeks that grow wild in the woods.
Where they grow like crazy. And in some places for miles on a mountainside, in the middle of nowhere, down a railroad track that nobody knows about, you know, that's where the ramp patch grows.
And we check in with a Methodist pastor and a Jewish rabbi. Both say that even though the pandemic is keeping their congregations at home, in some ways it's made them even more connected.
So what I did is to, you know, try to help people think about where they are as being a church, even though they're not all gathered with people. Some of them are on their own, but I gave them the liturgy so they could read that story and start outside their home.
Those stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Zach Harold, guest hosting this week's episode. Usually this is the time of year when my family and I pile into our car for weekend road trips throughout West Virginia. It's so strange to not be doing that this spring. It's just like it was surreal to not get all dressed up and go to church on Easter morning like I've done every Easter my entire life. The global pandemic is disrupting lots of our traditions, but at the same time, it's bringing us back to other pieces of our heritage. Traditions that helped our great-grandparents survive the Great Depression and two world wars. Things like gardening, sewing, and baking. We ask you to share your stories about traditions you've returned to, and a lot of you reached out. One mother in the eastern panhandle of West Virginia says she's found herself homeschooling her daughters and incorporating some baking traditions into their day. Folkways reporter Caitlin Tan brings us the story.
Carrie Namlick lives in Shepherdstown with her husband and two daughters. She's an assistant professor for Blue Ridge Community and Technical College and is working from home because of the pandemic. But like many parents, she's also found herself homeschooling her two girls, Scarlett and Lila. She's been using baking as a way to implement some math.
Okay, so then I split up our flour here because we have a half of a cup in each one, and the recipe calls for a cup.
But also just to practice old-school kitchen skills.
What are we making today?
We're making popovers!
Those are flaky light rolls that are an American adaptation of England's Yorkshire pudding, a recipe that dates back to the 17th century. Popovers are made with eggs.
A little harder. Oh, perfect. There you go.
And butter, milk, salt, and flour.
Good, good. Okay, now mix all that flour into it.
It looks so yucky.
It looks yucky.
I know, it looks like hard milk.
Hard milk.
Hard milk.
Well, it'll be yummy once you mix it all.
Yummy!
Traditionally, Appalachians have relied on baking as a way to provide food for the family. Namlick is a self-taught baker who has baked consistently for the past 10 years, but is leaning on the skill more during the pandemic.
Nobody else is leaving the house except for me whenever I go on those grocery store trips. So the least amount of time that I have to leave, the less likely my family is to be exposed. So yeah, I've been trying to do at least a week and a half or 2 weeks at a time.
Earlier in March, stores were all sold out of bread as people braced for social distancing. But Namlick has now also noticed a shortage of yeast and flour.
Well, right now I'm down to my last bag. I'm hoping at least that means other people are trying to bake their own things now since I can't find it.
And there's truth to that. Online things like isolation loaves and quarantine cookies are trending. And according to Nielsen data, yeast purchases are up 600% in March. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan.
In this time of social distancing, have you found yourself making things at home, either out of necessity or just for fun? We'd love to hear from you. Send an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Many of you also shared with us that you've been spending a lot of your time gardening. So what might this pandemic reveal about our food system moving forward? Turns out, it's increased the appetite for food from local farmers. When I'm not making radio, I handle communications for the WVU Extension Service Family Nutrition Program. We work with low-income folks around the state to promote healthy habits. And one way we do that is with the Grow This program, which encourages participants to grow their own vegetables. A few weeks ago, before I knew I'd be hosting this episode of Inside Appalachia, WVPB energy and environment reporter Brittany Patterson reached out to me about our tiny program. Well, it used to be tiny. I'll let her take it from here.
That is the sound of me planting what I hope in a few months will be zucchini. Like many people, I look forward to spring, not just for warm temperatures and sunnier days, but for the chance to begin my summer garden. To be clear, I'm not new to gardening. I actually grew up on an organic farm. But one of the big sells of moving to West Virginia from Washington, D.C. 2 years ago was the thought of having a big backyard garden. And we have, to varying degrees of success. But this year, thanks in large part to forced self-isolation, it feels different. Being outside, putting my hands in the dirt, planting this garden, this is the stuff my daydreams are made of right now. And as it turns out, I am not alone.
The last couple of years, we've had probably around like 200 participants for the whole campaign. And they've, you know, kind of filtered in as the summer months went on.
That's Kristen McCartney, a public health specialist with WVU Extension. And she heads up an online gardening program they run called Grow This. The program aims to get more West Virginians into gardening and provides free seeds for four crops to anyone in the state.
This year, within 3 days of posting the first post for the year, we had over 1,000 people sign up, and we now have over 5,000.
When I found out about this program a few weeks ago, even I signed up. This year, as the coronavirus pandemic was unfolding here in the U.S., McCartney promoted Grow This with an image of a victory garden, the wartime gardens that were popular during World War I and World War II.
Victory garden. That's the answer. We can grow food for victory in our own backyards, and even in vacant lots, where perhaps only weeds flourished before.
And in the time of COVID-19, McCartney says the idea of growing more food seems to have hit a nerve with many West Virginians.
I think that resonated with people, that this is a time to kind of pull together as a community and do what we can for ourselves and other people around us. And so part of that right now is just staying home. And another part is, you know, ensuring that our food supply is secure and people can be fed.
There's another role the state's local food system is playing. There are more than 20,000 farms in West Virginia, and 97% of them are considered small. 93% are family-owned, according to the USDA. Fritz Bettner is a farmer and heads up the Turn Row Appalachian Food Collective. The organization serves as a food hub and helps get produce from dozens of small growers into the hands of schools, restaurants, and people across Central Appalachia. And he says business right now, well,
our cooler is full and we had our biggest sales week in our history this week.
He says Turn Row is seeing people flock to their online ordering system to get their hands on fresh produce, which is good because the virus has also majorly impacted where West Virginia farmers were selling their food.
Restaurants were our biggest market channel. It has, you know, obviously those market channels have stopped buying because restaurants are closing down. They're not having the volume.
And as schools close their doors, they too stop buying local produce. Bettner says, like many of us who are wondering how long this pandemic will last, farmers are concerned. But the massive influx of individuals buying local produce from Turn Row actually gives him a lot of hope.
We need to have a food system intact as we weather this crisis because we don't know how long it's going to go on for. We need to think about food security, and our food system in West Virginia and Central Appalachia will help, you know, get us through this. And I think people, in my mind, are sort of wanting to invest in that. Like, okay, we got to make sure we have this. We better invest in our local farmers because we're going to need them.
For now, Bettner says he and other farmers at Turn Row are staying the course, fulfilling orders of locally grown produce while keeping social distancing guidelines in mind. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
After that story originally aired a few weeks ago, interest in the program exploded. Now more than 25,000 West Virginians have signed up to receive seeds. we just heard, many folks are responding to the pandemic with a renewed interest in growing their own food. So here's our Folkways reporter, Caitlin Tan, about some Appalachians who are growing things as a way to pass the time, but also in preparation for what may or may not come during the pandemic.
Amy Nicely is a career development specialist in Parkersburg, West Virginia. She's been working from home, homeschooling her kids, and growing a garden.
We don't have a food shortage, but the lack of ability to go out whenever you want to get food, it kind of brought back some of my roots from my childhood.
Nicely grew up in rural West Virginia, hunting, fishing, and gardening. She says having fresh chicken eggs and snacking on deer jerky or cherry tomatoes are some of her favorite memories. And so after years of not having a garden, Nicely decided to tap into her Appalachian roots and harvest her own food this year. So far, she's growing broccoli, onions, summer squash, and tomatoes. Nicely says it's also been a learning opportunity for her kids.
Even if it's just a healthy habit of growing your own vegetables, being able to take care of yourself to some degree, working hard and then reaping the benefits.
Growing a garden this year is trending in the Mountain State. Brady Walker is an 8-year-old who lives in Mercer County, and for the past 4 years, he's been sending donated seeds to people who want to start a garden. And this year, he says he's seen more interest than ever. Typically, he gives out around 1,000 seed packets, but this year, Walker is sending out over 4,000. He says giving people the opportunity to grow plants that can harvest food year after year is important to him. Walker learned to garden from his grandpa, or his poppy. And the biggest tip he learned?
Weed it every day.
Weed it every day. Walker says that's the trick to a successful garden. In Hampshire County, Susan Feller, a fiber artist, is also growing a garden this year. She says it's the first time she's planted a full garden in 10 years.
So to me, a garden as it grows is a teaching tool. It's confidence that life is going on.
Confidence that we, West Virginia, the United States, will make it through the pandemic, Feller says. She's drawing on what she learned growing up. Feller worked on an herb farm and her mother gardened.
Oh, I remember. I can plant the gardens this way. I can plant the marigolds around the edge and theoretically the deer won't get into them.
And Feller's been foraging, something she also learned on the herb farm. Lately, she's been collecting dandelions.
My partner does all the cooking, so he cooks them down and adds some anchovies into it, and it's great. I'm on my way out today. We're going to pick some more.
According to the WVU Extension Service, the next few weeks are a great time to begin seeding carrots, sweet corn, Swiss chard, and herbs. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Caitlin Tan.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Zach Harrell, guest hosting this week's show. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to many disappointing cancellations, from proms and graduations to birthday parties and baseball games. But not every springtime ritual has been canceled. This is still the season for eating ramps. Most Inside Appalachia listeners know that ramps are a type of wild onion, closely related to leeks. They're native to the eastern U.S. and Canada and are found in abundance in much of the Appalachian Mountains. But poaching has stripped ramps from some forests. As demand for ramps intensifies in larger cities, there are people who dig them and ship them outside of Appalachia. And climate change could pose an added risk to one of Appalachia's stinkiest natural resources. Personally, I love the taste of ramps, even if the smell makes my wife scoot her chair a little farther away at the dinner table. But what I especially love is the tradition that you find in many Appalachian communities of ramp feeds. On a spring day last April, Park Ranger Caroline Blizzard took a small group of people to a hillside in Garrett County, Maryland, with the sole purpose of finding ramps. Photographer and filmmaker Michael Snyder tagged along to record her for the Mountain Traditions Project. He learned that the ramps Caroline finds are then used for a community cook-off. More on that later, but for now, we join Caroline on her annual hunt for ramps.
The goal is each person one market sack full-ish.
One bag?
You can do two, but remember, we got to clean them later. Whoop whoop! Ramp digging day! So excited. So we're in the mountains of Western Maryland. That's as close as I'm going to give you. Somewhere deep in Garrett County. A well-held secret, digging ramps at our traditional ramp patch.
So a ramp is the best onion available. So take your thoughts of garlic, your thoughts of leeks, and your thoughts of onions, and put that all into one delicious spring bulb, and that's what a ramp is. Coming fresh from the forest, only available for about 2 weeks. It's kind of like maple syrup. It's finite, right? Once the sugar in the sap shifts in the maple trees, production's done. Once these guys go to bloom or start to seed, it's over. So you get a really good, you know, it's the freshest, the snow's just off. They're just delicious. All right, so we'll go over the process again, mainly for you guys, once we get down there. All right, you ready? Wait, where's the blindfolds? Just kidding. So ramps really require a specific slope, a specific sun to grow, soil pH, a wetness. But as you can see, where they grow like crazy. And in some places for miles on a mountainside, in the middle of nowhere, down a railroad track that nobody knows about, you know, that's where the ramp patch grows. And watch the wildflowers as you go too. So look at the trout lily blooming.
This one right there. Awesome. They're so pretty.
All right, let's start. So everybody's got their own favorite and different tool, as you can see. We've got long shovels, we have crowbars. I have a hori hori knife in here somewhere. You want to spread out. We don't want to look like we've been here, and it'll be easy to not do that. Obviously, we're going to see that we've been walking through it because there's a bunch of us, but it will recover. When you sit down, like you decide you're going to dig here, you're going to just pick a few out of this one spot, right? And you're going to leave the rest. So you want to get straight down under the root, and if you clip the roots off as you get better at doing this, all the better, because you're leaving the roots behind. Your first pile of ramps. All right. Divide and conquer. All right, go forth. Does anybody want my hori hori knife? I grew up knowing of a thing called a ramp because my cousins would come and slide a jar across the table to my grandfather and say, here's the yearly ramps. And so I knew it existed. I knew it delighted him whenever that ramp jar came. And then we had done our first ramp cook-off, and newspapers had picked it up, and some of my grandfather's brothers emailed me and started telling stories. And during that ramp cook-off, old-timers were coming, same thing, telling the stories. We started a memory book. People were writing down what they remembered of ramps. And now when I'm in a patch like this, invariably I hear my grandmother at some point talking to me, or my grandfather, you know, Uncle Bud is saying, you need some butter and some white bread and make yourself a sandwich. So for me, it really connects to my ancestors. And I think it does that for a lot of people. And I enjoy bringing that back up into the culture. And I enjoy bringing it to new folks who maybe don't have that connection to it, but now maybe have it through me. So the secrets to finding a good ramp patch is word of mouth. We never knew this was here. We spend all our time at this camp other than in April, and had no idea the patch was here till they said, and went, it was like, wow. So someone gave up their secret, which is how we found it. So it's a more coveted thing, but a ramp is a ramp. It's not cultivatable. It doesn't want to grow where it doesn't want to grow. So I think it keeps it safer. It protects it a little bit, protects the heritage around what the ramp is. We're not mass producing them in farm fields. You still have to really work to get it and know someone to do it. Climate-wise, it seems to be doing pretty good. What climate change will do to it, is yet to be seen. I mean, it's very specific. Its habitat, its temperatures, its specific everything, and the specific everything is changing for a lot of species. So I don't know that anybody's looked at the ramps or have noticed it yet. We haven't here, but it's hard to say what the future's going to bring in terms of that. Whenever you guys feel like it, being done, we're probably good. The more you pick, the better the ice cream.
What we're making this morning are some hash browns and ramps. We call them rampy hash browns. I'm also going to be frying up some eggs with ramps and some poblano peppers. So just give everybody a little taste on a beautiful morning and start the day off right with some ramps and eggs.
So
we're at the Deep Creek Lake State Park Discovery Center. We're at the 18th annual ramp cook-off.
I made a ramp and bacon jam.
We have made boudin balls, but we mix ramps and cover them in breadcrumbs and fried them.
We have, this is a version of an old German potato pancake recipe. And they're potato cheddar ramp pancakes with ramp butter for on top of them, which is just real butter with the ramp leaves in it, and some of the ramp balls too. And this is cream cheese ramp dip to go with the crackers.
This year I'm making a Mexican street corn fritter. There's some ramps in it. It's just corn and masa, lime and chili with the ramps, of course, and the water. We'll fry it up in the pan.
We always judge on rampiness, and it became pretty clear early that a raw ramp is inherently rampier than a cooked ramp, so we divided into two categories, and now we have a cooked and a raw ramp category. And the winner takes home the coveted jar of pickled ramps from last year's season. So they've been stewing for a year, and they get the pickled ramps and a certificate and bragging rights for a year. Hopefully that's worth something. Judging. So once you're set up, go ahead and step away. I'll walk around with the judge. We have a long-standing judge who's been a judge from the beginning, Kevin Dodge. He's a community staple, and he never passes up a free meal. And then I typically just pull someone from the crowd to be the judge, so there's always this impartial someone who's not, maybe not even familiar with ramps, so kind of coming at it blind purely from taste.
So how much?
One of my favorite, freelance bands of the 90s, Bacon Ramp Jam. Yeah.
Okay, so do you want
it
with
the Telfest.
With the apple or without?
I think you should take it with the apple.
Well, yeah, I think you want to do. Now, do you want to put a piece of cheese with it?
It's with it.
It's already
there. Oh, it's already with it. Okay. There you go. All right. Well, I'm gonna go for the entire poo-poo platter.
Okay. So I'll do the same.
Let the stink begin.
Yeah, bacon makes everything better.
All right. Number one, and this was really cool, and obviously this has to do with originality. This really is good tasting. The sweet and savory chocolate and sea salt batter dipped ramps. It also gets a second award for the longest name. So anyhow, so thank you all so much. This is such a, isn't it a gorgeous time of year? Even though it's cold.
That story was produced by Leah Scarpelli and is part of the Mountain Traditions Project, directed by Michael O. Snyder and funded by the Community Trust Foundation. We've posted a link on our website where you can see photos and learn more about the project. It's at wvpublic.org. By the way, ramp digging is forbidden in some parks and forests, including the Great Smoky Mountains National Park in Tennessee. Officials there banned ramp digging in the forest after overharvesting has hurt the plants. Ramp digging for personal use is allowed in the Monongahela National Forest in West Virginia, though the agency recommends only collecting ramps in patches with more than 100 plants. Experts ask that people take only 1/5 of the plants in large clumps. This ensures the ramp patches can regenerate. Use small forks or hand trowels while digging ramp bulbs rather than large shovels. Harvesting for a business or commercial use is not allowed in any national park or forest. If you've spent any time at all looking for an Appalachian-themed quarantine read, you've probably heard about The Third Rainbow Girl. At first glance, it looks like a true crime read about the 1980 murders of two women on their way to the Rainbow Gathering in Pocahontas County. But the book is also largely about its author, Emma Copley Eisenberg. She learned of the murders around 2009 when she was working in the county as a VISTA volunteer. Fast forward to 2020. Emma turned the story of those murders into her first book, The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia, which intersperses the true crime narrative with a memoir about the author's own time in the county. The book received good reviews from critics across the country, but we've heard from some folks in Pocahontas County who have not responded well to this book or the fact that it stirs up a dark episode they'd rather put behind them. This book might be new, but it's part of an old story. What happens when strangers come to Appalachia? What happens when they try to tell our story? There's a long history of pop culture mischaracterizing and stereotyping Appalachians, from the Beverly Hillbillies to Hillbilly Elegy. That's why we asked Doug Van Gundy to offer his take on this book. He's a writer, professor of English, and director of West Virginia Wesleyan College's MFA program in Buchanan, West Virginia. He also happened to live in Pocahontas County when the case of the Rainbow Girls murder went to trial in the 1990s. He was working at a local community radio station at the time. As you'll hear, Van Gundy has mixed feelings about the book, which he found to be more than just a true crime story. He sent us this review.
After her sophomore year of college, Emma Copley Eisenberg came to Pocahontas County, West Virginia to work at a summer camp that helps local girls develop confidence, creativity, and academic skills. 2 years later, she returned as an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer to work full-time for the organization that ran the camp. Over the next year and a half, she taught drama and creative writing, coordinated the camp's after-school program, and befriended many of the locals. From them, she learned of the infamous Rainbow Murders, the 1980 killings of Vicky Durian and Nancy Santamaro, two young women who'd been traveling together to the annual Rainbow Family Gathering. Something about the killings and their aftermath resonated with Eisenberg. Maybe it was that, like her, the murdered girls were young and idealistic and had come to West Virginia longing for community. Whatever the source of her fascination, after Eisenberg left West Virginia, she found that in her journals and notes from her time in Pocahontas County, she had already begun writing her first book, The Third Rainbow Girl. I lived in Pocahontas County for over a decade. I was program director at the local community radio station during its coverage of the first Rainbow trial in 1993, and I was still living in the community during the retrial that overturned Jacob Beard's conviction in 2000. My wife and I were among the first volunteer tutors in the program Eisenberg calls Mountain Views. Because part of her story focuses on friends and former neighbors, and because I knew the public side of the Rainbow trial so well, I read Eisenberg's book with great interest, and perhaps a little prejudice. The Third Rainbow Girl is a blend of true crime writing, cultural criticism, and coming-of-age story, weaving together the 1980 killing of Dorian and Santamaro and Emma Eisenberg's experience of coming to West Virginia as an AmeriCorps volunteer. Eisenberg treats the tale of Dorian and Santamaro with tenderness and humanity, laying out their backstories clearly and precisely. She manages to present the huge cast of supporting characters that surrounded the investigation into the killings, suspects, prosecutors, police, reporters, witnesses, in a way that's both easy to follow and compelling to read. And when the story she's telling is her own, the self-portrait is one of a real, flawed human being. When making the decision to return to Mountain Views as an AmeriCorps Vista, she writes, "I did not understand my own feelings. I felt mixed up, with the sense of foreboding guilt that always accompanies our most important lies." Lies. Lies are crucial to Eisenberg's story. The lies told by and about suspects in the murder case, and the lies Eisenberg tells herself about why she does the work she does, and what she's willing to do to be liked. Eventually, she tries to unveil her own lies so that we may look them in the eye. That she refuses to make her own story tidy and neat, which would be easy alongside the jumbled mess that the Rainbow case became, is a testament to her commitment to the real story, as unpleasant as it may be. Despite the subject and the setting, this is not, at its heart, a book about West Virginia or Pocahontas County or the difference between truth and perception or even the murders of Vicky Durian and Nancy Santamaro. It is about Emma Copley Eisenberg and her occasionally painful, often self-destructive quest to understand herself. Her obsession with the Rainbow murders may have served as the catalyst, but The Third Rainbow Girl is pure memoir, cloaked in reportage.
Doug Van Gundy is a professor of English at West Virginia Wesleyan College and directs the college's MFA program in Buchanan, West Virginia. He reviewed The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia by Emma Copley Eisenberg. As I mentioned earlier, there are mixed feelings about this book among some West Virginians. Our associate producer, Eric Douglas, interviewed Eisenberg about her book and asked her to comment on some of the criticisms people in Pocahontas County have of it.
On June 25th, 1980, Vicky Durian and Nancy Santomero were killed in Pocahontas County. They were on their way to the Rainbow Gathering. Jacob Beard was convicted of the murder in 1993, but he was later acquitted of all charges in a second trial in 2000 after Joseph Paul Franklin, a white supremacist and serial killer, confessed to the murders. Franklin was put to death in 2013 for a different murder, but he was never tried for the murders of the Rainbow Girls. So tell me about – kind of lay out the timeline of the murders and the aftermath.
Okay, so Vicky and Nancy's bodies are found in Pocahontas County on June 25th. The Rainbow Gathering is already underway. There's some initial investigation that's very rigorous. Many people are interviewed. The case essentially languishes for about 4 years. There are some additional interviews and confessions and accusations in 1984, and then essentially the investigation is protracted and goes on sort of fallow into the late 80s. Due to a few different factors, investigators moving away, moving back in the late 80s, there's kind of a resurgence in trying to, quote, solve the case. And then in the early 90s is when the prosecution starts to put together a case against a local guy, Jacob Beard, and about seven other men who they believe are involved. Jacob Beard is tried in 1993 and convicted. He serves 6 years, and there are a series of confessions during those years that he's in prison by this guy, this serial murderer, Joseph Paul Franklin. Jacob Beard is retried in 2000 and found not guilty.
I was interested when I was reading the book how many different
The
confessions and this person did this and you know the accusations and
yes.
I don't know how the police made any sense of it and much less you making any sense of it after the fact. That was a lot going on that didn't even seem to make any sense.
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting and complicated things about this case is, yes, how many people confessed at different points, how many people's statements of what happened conflict with other statements. And that is ultimately kind of what I try to make the book about, is that there's always, you know, another version of the truth that contradicts someone else's version, and we may never really know.
There's a section in the book where you insert some of your personal life and personal experiences in Pocahontas County. Why did you choose to do that?
At first, I didn't. At first, this was a book solely about the Rainbow Murders, but I felt that because I'm not from the area and it's not my story is not one of being raised in the county and growing up with these murders as my reality, that it felt important to acknowledge where I was from and what my position in encountering the community in Pocahontas County was, which was in this kind of strange middle period between being an outsider and being an insider. I hope the book will speak to readers both inside the county and elsewhere, but I want to make sure that readers elsewhere also understand that Pocahontas County is a contemporary place that's living and breathing, that is not something of the past.
You know, in West Virginia, and I'm sure you've heard the term, we struggle a lot with parachute journalism, people dropping in from outside and that sort of thing, telling a perspective that's not – That let's just say the locals don't necessarily agree with.
Yeah.
Do you think your choice to include your personal history in this is conflicting with telling the story of the Rainbow Murders at all, or did it interfere in any way?
I don't think that I would be able to write a book that was 100% about the Rainbow Murders. That's not a book that I know how to write, I think. And I still don't intend this book to be the definitive history of these crimes. I welcome and hope that there are other projects out there. I know that there's already a documentary project happening made by a local Pocahontas County person, and I welcome that research and reporting, even if it's in conflict with mine. This was the book that I feel is most truthful to what I can offer.
As I'm sure you know, there are some people in Pocahontas County who are not thrilled with your telling of the book and your portrayal of Pocahontas County.
Yes.
So what's your response to that?
I think that that's completely valid. I think that people's anger is valid. I think that they're allowed to be angry. I think that I hope that anger becomes a site of conversation for me, for them, about the questions I try to raise in the book. I do welcome that feedback. I've said, you know, from the beginning that I am happy to assist people who want to make that view known or a different view known. I think that intentions are not good enough. I think execution is what matters. And so if people feel the execution is faulty, that's important. And I hear that. And also, I think it's important for folks to know that I have more than intentions, a genuine love for that place.
When you set out to write this and started to tell that part of the story, you were on a path of your own discovery, and along with while telling the story, how did you get off into the community and the things that would cause some of these people to be angry?
I think something that I heard from people that I talked to early on for this book who are involved in the events of the past, something that they said was, it's not enough to write a book about these events. What's the point? Like, what is the point of retelling this story again? And I agree with that. If we are not going to think about what it means in a broader sense, I didn't feel that there was a point in writing that book. I didn't want to write a true crime book that is a page-turner about who killed the Rainbow Girls. That isn't my intent and never was. What I wanted to write was a book that explored what these crimes mean and what people in the county can take from these events, what people outside the county can take from these events. And I wanted to write a book that was a better narrative of this story generally, its themes. I think for me, it ends up being a story about the ways that being Appalachian people are told is shameful and the ways that fighting against that story can also have profound, disastrous results.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, that in many ways, the investigation of these crimes, I think, was the larger trauma to the community than the deaths themselves. That there was a lot of harm done to Pocahontas because these women happened to die in this place. And I hope that people feel in some way relieved of some guilt.
That was Emma Copley Eisenberg talking with Eric Douglas about her book, The Third Rainbow Girl, The Long Life of a Double Murder in Appalachia, which was published earlier this year. We'd like to hear your thoughts about this book. If you're familiar with the story or have read this book, do you think it continues the negative stereotypes about Appalachia? Do you think it covers our region with sincerity? What do you take away from the strong reactions to the book? Send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or tweet us at @InAppalachia. I'm Zach Harold. You're listening to Inside Appalachia, and we'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we've talked about several ways people are finding comfort at home during this crisis. You know, during other times of national turmoil, many people have sought comfort in their churches or synagogues or mosques. But those places are inaccessible to us now as a result of social distancing requirements. So I wanted to talk to some faith leaders about how they've been able to serve their congregations while still keeping everybody safe. I recently spoke with Rabbi Victor Yurecki of the B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston and Pastor David Johnston of the Concord United Methodist Church in Athens. Each has begun offering services online. Rabbi Yurecki says his digital services are reconnecting the synagogue with former members who have since left the state.
Religion by its nature is community-oriented. It's to be together. The word religion means to bind oneself. And I always thought to bind oneself, not necessarily to God, but to each other. And the very fact that this pandemic has made it that we cannot be together has forced us to rethink and reimagine what religion can be in the 21st century under these circumstances.
Rabbi Yarecki says that before the coronavirus, the Sabbath was always observed in very specific ways. But doing things over the internet has forced the congregation to evolve.
The Sabbath, for example, in our traditional Jewish world, we do not use electronic devices. But in order for us to stay connected, we are going to have to use that.
And so, despite how foreign this was to Rabbi Yarecki and his congregants, B'nai Jacob Synagogue began offering services through the video conferencing app Zoom. Down in Mercer County, West Virginia pastor David Johnston started trying to stream his services online, too.
That first Sunday just got on Facebook Live, but I'm here in southern West Virginia, and internet isn't always what one would hope it would be, so we found it a little bit too choppy.
So instead, Johnston switched to pre-recorded videos of his services, which he then posts to YouTube.
If I thought Zoom was something that would work for us here, I would love to do that because I think it better approximates what worship is, which is about us gathering as a community to worship God, to tell these stories that make us who we are.
One major adjustment for both the pastor and the rabbi has been continuing to observe religious holidays, even though they can't see their faith communities face to face. On Palm Sunday, for example, Pastor Johnston went and delivered palm branches to the porches of his church members' homes.
So what I did is to, you know, try to help people think about where they are as being a church, even though they're not all gathered with people. Some of them are on their own, but I gave them the liturgy so they could read that story and start outside their home.
I created a Zoom Seder with some contemporary components where people could either record it and then use it in their Seder later on that night. They could do it live, so they would have in front of them the same objects that I have in front of me as I did it. Or they could add new stuff to it, or they can just listen and visualize the story. What I tried to emphasize for my congregation quite a bit is, while ritual is very important, in our tradition, the story is equally important. And I think the pastor will agree on that. It's the story of Jesus. It's the story of the Exodus from Egypt. And it's also the story of disciples who, down through the centuries, have explored, studied, used ritual, and used their imagination to keep that story going for the next generation. It is not lost upon me as we're recording this that tonight we begin Yom HaShoah, which is Holocaust Remembrance Day. And Jews were able to remember the Exodus from Egypt even in the concentration camps. Now, obviously, they didn't have the provisions that we had in front of us very easily. And yet, they passionately, vibrantly, and with a great deal of enthusiasm celebrated even in the most horrible of conditions. They were able to tell the story, and their stories that we now have through the memories of survivors become powerful reminders of how religion is maintained, even under the most adverse situations. So the very fact that we can't take communion fully, the very fact that we can't celebrate Passover fully, adds to the fabric of the telling of the religious stories that are meaningful. So the stories of 2020 will be part of the fabric of 2021, 2022, 2023, where we'll be talking about, do you remember what we did and how we kept the traditions of our people going? And who knows, you know, one day I will be, hopefully may I live and be well, telling my grandson, who was too young to experience the Passover fully, didn't know what was going on, but I said, you know, when you were just a baby, this is how we celebrated in 2020. I know it sounds weird, but that's how important that celebration was to us. And we did some really interesting things. And those become part of his narrative that he will tell his children, God willing, one day about how his grandfather, a blessed memory, kept the tradition going.
That's a really beautiful thought about the ritual connecting us to the story. Rabbi, as you were talking, I was thinking about how the story of Passover is a story of people huddled in their houses waiting for God to do something. And, you know, the story of Easter, after Good Friday, the disciples go and hide themselves away and wait to see what happens. So in both stories, there's this element of people being closed in, away from everybody else. Do you think that having to practice this social distancing has maybe brought the stories a little more alive in the hearts and minds of your congregations?
What I would like to look at is what it has done for congregants who have maybe taken for granted the stories and the rituals, things that we do because we know that's what we're supposed to do. We kind of go through the motions. This year, we didn't go through the motions. We had to reimagine and recreate. Next year, God willing, and hopefully there's a vaccine by then and life will turn to somewhat normal, I think we'll look back on this moment with a greater appreciation than of the things that we've been taking for granted. So maybe precisely because of these hunkered down moments, that's how religion becomes reawakened. We take it for granted for too long, and we need these moments to kind of reset it and remind us of why we're really doing it, why it's important to us, and how we keep translating and reimagining. I'm reimagining and rethinking what Judaism needs to be for this congregation. As the pastor knows, we're a small mom-and-pop congregation because the Jews are very small here in Charleston. We never thought we needed anything electronic to be Jewish in West Virginia. Now we're discovering, well, you know what? There is a great thirst among people that maybe are too far away to be a part of our community. That is a reawakening and something we kind of took for granted and we didn't think it through. And so these are going to be, again, from the challenges will come opportunities.
You know, eventually it'll be safe to go back to church, to go back to synagogue. But I wonder, do you have any vision what that's going to look like?
This online presence we now have is something that I hope we can continue because it helps us reach more people and different people than we would before. Because even before this, I have congregation members with compromised immune systems who are ready for, like, during flu season, stay home and just miss church for 4 or 5 months out of the year. And they have been so thrilled that they've been able to come back to worship before they would have otherwise. And like I said, since we've connected with people who don't normally come to church too, I mean, a lot of churches were already online and they know this, that there are people who will watch for a certain amount of time online before they ever darken the doors. And it's really made me think about something my dad told me some years back. He was very active in going on mission trips to Cuba with the Methodist Church of Cuba, which is growing quite rapidly. And I happened to go on one of these trips with my dad, and their church building was not much more than a picnic shelter. I mean, it was a roof with half walls, open air, bench seats. And when we would hold church, I mean, it was packed out, people standing outside, but there would also be quite a lot of people walking up and down the street, which was not normal because we were around the church helping fix it up other days. But what my dad told me is that one way the church there has reached new people is because, you know, in Cuba, it's hot and they don't have air conditioning, so the windows are usually open. But it means the music and the message and what's going on kind of wafts out and people can look in without having to come in. And that's what I think this turn to digital has done, is it's opened windows into what we do, where people who are curious can look in without that sense of risk of having to step through the door, you know, like Rabbi Yarecki was saying. And so I hope we can keep the windows open so that people can stay curious about these stories that we tell.
It almost takes something cataclysmic to force us to rethink and reimagine. I think that's kind of what happened here. And it took something like this to say, well, temporarily we have to do something different. And we're reluctant. We don't want to do it. And I'm thinking back to myself in terms of, oh my gosh, how is this going to happen on Sabbath and festivals? And yet, because we were forced kicking and screaming into this new reality, at least temporarily, I started to discover there's some opportunities here. There are people outside of West Virginia who want to be a part of our community still and will always be a part. And there are people, as the pastor said, that cannot, for whatever reason, come to services. And we kind of said, well, we're too small to do that. Well, now we're discovering we're not too small to do that. We're big enough to do a lot of neat things. And so I think post the coronavirus pandemic, we're going to look at the pieces here and not just say, okay, well, I'm glad this is over. Now let's go back to normal. But wow, there were some really neat things that happened during this time. How do we incorporate that into the religious life of our community? And as a result, we will be, I think, a stronger community.
That was Rabbi Victor Yarecki, rabbi at the B'nai Jacob Synagogue in Charleston, West Virginia, and Pastor David Johnston, pastor at the Concord United Methodist Church in Athens, West Virginia. Thank you both so much for coming on today and speaking with me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Zach.
The pandemic has taken things from all of us, some more than others. I'm lucky. I still have my job and no one I know is sick. But I haven't hugged my mom in almost 2 months now, and I missed my sister's 30th birthday. One of my uncles died and I wasn't able to go to the funeral. Yet the pandemic has given me things, too. I've spent so much time with my wife and little girl. I went hunting for morel mushrooms for the first time in my life. Didn't find any, but I still went. And I learned the hard way that I don't look good with a buzz cut. I recently caught myself saying I couldn't wait until things get back to normal. But that's not exactly true. What I really want is a new normal, where we can enjoy our family and friends, but this time not take it for granted. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we travel throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Mountain Traditions Project. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by the Dinosaur Burps, Pergola and Mike Voss, and Spencer Elliott. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glennis Board. Brittany Patterson edited our show this week. We also had help this week from Helen Barrington from PMJA's Editor Corps. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. I'm Zach Harold. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. My Twitter handle is at Zach Harold, and that's Zach with a CK. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There you can also subscribe or download all of our stories, or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.